This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for January 2013. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we have readings from Barbara Perez.
A mind when playing tricks is at its most sincere.
Matthew Nino.
How imprecise the smell of desire.
And we're going to talk with Laura Kosicki about Wallace Stevens, whose poems, it turns out, she doesn't seem to like all that much.
Like, what is it, concupiscence, curds? I just don't say that, so it always comes as a surprise to me again when I see it and think, ah, these curds.
The prose in the January issue includes a notebook from Peter Cole, which is about influence and mysticism and lots of other things, as well as an essay by Ilya Kaminsky on the strangeness in the poems of Paul Celan.
As for poetry, we have poems by Brad Lighthouser, Barbara Hamby, Jean Ray, Fanny Howe, and several others. Chris, you go first this time. What would you like to read?
We have an interesting poet leading off the issue named Sarah Miller, and there was a striking little poem which might pair well with the Stevens when we get to it later. This is called Countermeasures. I wish I could keep my thoughts in order and my ducks in a row. I wish I could keep my ducks in a thought or my thoughts in a duck. My point is that we all exist, wetly, in the hunt. The ducks are aware of this in their own way, which is floating. The way of the mind is brevity. There may be other thoughts on other days in the minds of other and better men and their constant companions, the women, but these same tidy capsules, never. This is just one of the things I noticed about my thoughts as they passed easefully by. I love this. Yeah. That poem about ducks, and it has a wonderful buoyancy to it, and you will not resolve this poem.
It's not,
you're not going to sort of figure it out.
Well, it does take something from Stevens, the idea that language has its own imaginative existence, that it creates a world all of its own, which is tethered in some essential way to the world that we live in and that's embodied for us in our day-to-day living. But you can see the poet here turning that phrase over and over in her mind, mm-hmm. ducks in a row, what does it mean?
Yeah.
And making a poem from it.
These same tidy capsules, never. There's a curious bit in the middle here. There may be other thoughts on other days in the minds of other and better men and their constant companions, the women. Mm. That's a strange way of going about
yeah.
it, right?
And yeah.
And you can't quite figure out, and we know this is a woman writing the poem, there seems to be some playful diminution of the women in this case, and yet it's not quite right. I mean, it seems to be wry and ironic and to have an edge to it.
One of the things that's so good about that is that the poem could just be a kind of joke or a one-liner, no
yeah.
pun intended, you know, when you just fool around with ducks in a row and your thoughts and stuff. And then what's interesting is the part you mentioned comes after the line that says the way of the mind is brevity, and it's immediately followed up by a very convoluted meditation.
That's a good point.
I mean, you do have to kind of go over and over them in your own mind and sort of unpack them, as they say.
Or just sort of meditate on it. The poem has to happen to you. You know, you can't quite enter it and figure
yeah.
it out. I think that's why it's called Countermeasures.
Yeah.
How about you? Is there one that you particularly liked?
Yes, there's a poem in this issue by Kelly Cherry called Their Pleas. And sadly, I think it came to mind hauntingly for me in view of some of the news that we had recently with the unfortunate disaster of the school shooting in Connecticut. But that event notwithstanding, this is a pretty haunting and interesting poem. Their Pleas. They pluck my sleeve, tug my hand, pull my hair. They do not kneel to kiss my hem. No, it's not like that, but they want tokens. Again, not souvenirs, but something small and useful, something that will help them out after life, maybe in an underworld. They need a sighted guide to lead them to the river, and they need a remnant of the old world as they embark for the older world, the one that has existed since the first grievous death. They need to feel they still can touch and still be touched, as once they did and were, and one would have to be a cold, uncaring woman to deny their pleas, a woman with a bulletproof heart without a memory of life on earth.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking poem.
Yeah.
That one will pair strikingly with one we'll look at later in the podcast, as a matter of fact, by a different poet. It is odd how the context of a poem can completely change it. I remember after 9/11 when the New Yorker published Adam Zagajewski's Praise of the Mutilated World, and he hadn't really written the poem for that occasion.
Right.
And or you think of Paul Celan's Death Fugue, which got completely changed in the way Germany took that poem up. And it's silly to think that you can erase all these things from the reading of poems, biography, and history, and what's going on at the moment.
Yeah, we read poems and read them the way we do many other things, and they are sort of abstract when we do that. It's, you know, you read a poem and you go, that's a pretty good poem, or I like that, or it's interesting. I did like this poem when we got it, but for some reason it became far more comprehensible to me in light of the tragedy and having to think about it, because it took on a fuller shape for me. You know, I could really find this to be real and concrete and not something that sounds good in a poem. You know, this question of how you guide people out of the world, you know, having to think about where grievous death began, the feeling that we have that the people we lose still can touch and be touched.
Exactly.
And then finally the idea that you would have to be an uncaring, in this case, an uncaring woman. The poet is a woman, but an uncaring person to deny the pleas of those who are leaving the world.
Without a memory of life on earth.
Yeah.
Without a memory of life as it actually is, as if these presences that make themselves felt in our lives every day are part of reality.
Yeah.
This is the first appearance in poetry of Barbara Perez, who teaches literature and composition at Northwest Vista College in San Antonio.
We have two of her poems in the issue, and the first we're going to hear comes out of her experiences as an epileptic.
There's something that many epileptics experience called an aura, where they can predict a seizure before it happens. So this is the experience running through the poem.
Here's Barbara Perez reading Strange Little Prophets.
When is the smell of a blackberry tree a harbinger of violent movement, rather than simply the recollection of a childhood Sunday dress, hem-dipped in mud, hand-printed with juice and seeds? Hard to say. A mind when playing tricks is at its most sincere, at home, raking through the body's history, repeating the strange and nostalgic. The taste of dirty copper, the imagined cockroach in the corner, the sluggish slow of the clock. Doctors call these strange little prophets warning signs of a seizure, synaptic misfires, looming like a song discordant, until the body, an unplucked string, is finally strummed.
There's a passage in Dostoevsky's diary where he talked, Dostoevsky had epilepsy and some of his characters have epilepsy, and he talks about those moments, that aura that Barbara Perez mentions, being worth all the rest of existence for him. I don't know if that's true for all epileptics, but for him, he thought of them as such mystical, rapturous experiences that they were worth the rest of existence.
Well, she does say, a mind when playing tricks is at its most sincere. And sincere is a complicated word, obviously, but I think it's meant sincerely here, that it's a reality that is disclosed. When the mind plays tricks, when that aura is signaling what's about to happen, which is accompanied by the activities of other senses.
The taste of dirty copper, the imagined cockroach in the corner, the sluggish slow of the clock.
Those details in the poem are just so tactile, so that the aura isn't just this sort of visual thing, but that it takes in all of the senses of the world around us, and the body is doing something else with these things.
We tend to reduce all of our experiences to biology and chemistry.
Yeah.
This poem complicates that considerably because she talks about the synaptic misfires. She knows what's going on, you know, biologically and neurologically and in the brain. And yet the way this poem ends, the body is strummed. And so to be strummed, you have to be strummed from outside of yourself.
right. Yeah, someone's doing it.
Right.
The musician.
And so it's like the old story of the Apostle Paul on the road to Damascus. A lot of people say, well, he had epilepsy, and who knows, maybe he did, but that doesn't obviate the other explanation, that maybe there was something from outside. As I think Barbara Perez is saying, for her, the experience is both internal and external.
Epilepsy is a subject that spills into more than just that one poem here. Barbara Perez told us that she's working on a chapbook of poems based on her experiences with it.
And sort of based on my stunted growth as a philosopher,
So we can't speak to her development as a philosopher exactly, but you can certainly hear a philosophical mind at work in the next poem we're going to hear. It's a passionate defense of what she believes will happen after we die, and it's called Not For You, Not For The World.
Not for you, not for the world. Because a little reprieve, a little hope, even for those whom I love, would exculpate the world of its actions. I hold to logic steadfast. Belief without knowledge dislodges perception of all the empirical world, even for you, Mom and Dad. Know that if for you, on some filthy lie, I could wish for the mind's persistence after death, I would say no.
Well, this is the opposite of the Kelly Cherry poem we read, right? Where you get these presences tugging at you from beyond and some sense of a survival of the love that we have in this life. And this poem says, no way.
Yeah. Right?
And it says it very differently. It reminds me in an odd way of Robinson Jeffers, where he would write these long rhetorical poems which make an argument, an odd sort of lapidary music.
Mm-hmm. It's a short poem, but the lines are long. Yeah. I mean, you notice that when you see it. It's a very determined poem. I hold to logic steadfast.
And it's angry too, right? Because it would exculpate the world of its actions. Ordinarily, you'd think God of his actions. But here it's the world, as if the world had actions.
Yeah, and also that the poem says,
know that if for you, on some filthy lie, I could wish for the mind's persistence after death, I would say no.
A filthy lie.
A filthy lie.
It's got a very determined polemic there.
It's a strange phrasing. It's on some filthy lie I could wish, rather than with some filthy lie or by means of some filthy lie I could wish. You're going to wish on a lie the way you wish on a star or something, right? How do you wish on a lie?
I guess we do that all the time.
Right, exactly, exactly. It seems very deliberate and effective. You know, it's like that Shakespeare line, we are such stuff as dreams are made on, you know, rather than of.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a poem that you don't want to gainsay, you know? It has its own authenticity. It has its own credibility. It also has its own faithfulness.
Even for you, Mom and Dad.
It's wonderful that she names them like that. It's suddenly this, you know, familiar domestic Mom and Dad, not
and
even
a,
my
it's
mother.
It's a parenthetical
right.
in the poem.
Right.
Even for you, Mom and Dad.
Right.
That's a tough-minded poem.
Yeah. This is also Matthew Nino's first appearance in the magazine. Matthew's latest chapbook from Codhill Press is called Marvelous Things Overheard.
A lot of poets teach to earn their living, but when he's not writing poetry, Matthew builds wooden boats.
I love both, but I think I need both. I need to actually go and make something with my hands or have some sort of work that is physical or requires a different engagement. And then from that, my poems are better, my attention is better.
And his work building boats naturally works its way into his poems.
One day I happened to find a beautiful piece of cocobolo, which is also called rosewood, in a scrap bin. And it's striking colors, yellows and oranges and browns, really distinct rings. And I picked this up and took it to the belt sander. And out of that experience, this poem arose.
It's called Ode to the Belt Sander and This Cocobolo Sapwood.
The belt kicks on with a whir, and the whir licks the end grain of the offcut with a hint of hesitation. A small wind of ochre dust sweeps off the belt before the belt comes back to where it was. The whole room swells with the scent of cinnamon and desire. How imprecise the smell of desire. The wood takes on a sheen, a gloss the grain can live behind without worry of being forgotten. A single knot blinks out of the small block and becomes the eye of a hummingbird, its beak bending around the edge of the wood, its small song captured in the annular rings. To think, this block was tossed in with the scraps, that the bird could have been lost or burned.
This is that old idea of the world somehow having inherent within it the work of art. There's a great line from Heaney, as if the stone remembered what the mallet tapped to know.
Right.
You remember that?
Yeah. But it also, I think, will remind readers of Neruda, you know, his odes to many subjects.
Yeah.
Here we have an ode to the belt sander. That gets your attention. And then, of course, that fantastic word cocobolo, which I think most of us don't use.
Yeah.
But it does invoke a kind of made thing in a different way than some of the more academic-sounding poems we come across.
It sure does. It almost indicts the kind of abstraction that we get in those poems, like how imprecise the smell of desire.
Yeah.
Desire is a word that's everywhere in contemporary poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And this poem seems to recognize that and then to counter it with all of these very specific things, even as it admits these specific things can't quite capture that desire.
Yeah.
There's a clever use of the word rings there.
It's small song captured in the annular rings.
You get the pun of rings.
Yeah.
It makes a sound.
Yeah. What I like about this poem is that it's in couplets and everything is joined together so nicely. It's just what you would expect from a guy who makes things with his hands.
Well, yeah, on that note, I mean, part of the pleasure of these poems is the education that they give you on boat building, or at least on the vocabulary of boat building. And here's the epigraph to his poem, Ode to the Steam Box.
The steam box is used for bending frames and planks in traditional boat building.
So I knew they had to have something that bends the wood, but I wouldn't
right.
have known. I really wouldn't have that it was the steam box. So a steam box is the large contraption that actually steams wood so that you can bend it beyond its natural breaking point. Here's Ode to the Steam Box.
With a match, I became a man who summoned diesel from the yellow caverns of a 10-gallon jug, called the flame now hissing out the hose at the small house of water, that rusted drum from which travels an excruciating wetness. This is what makes the body otherwise, what makes it sing. To take that which is decided on a shape and bend without breaking the lengthening fibers. To give the straight thing curve, to make of the tree a song grown long in a linseed skin, the slick, hot strake waiting to become parcel of the round world again.
In case you were wondering, a strake is a structural strip of planking that runs front to back on a vessel's side or bottom, so that might help you make sense of those last few lines.
The slick, hot strake waiting to become parcel of the round world again.
Well, this has wonderful, wonderful sounds. And I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about magic in poetry and how that occurs. And it's some combination of metaphor and sound. It sort of lifts you into another dimension. And not every poet, or even most poets, are capable of doing it.
Yeah.
You read a line like the beginning here, with a match I became a man. It seems to me that surely the poem had to start from that. That wonderful line with
yeah.
match and man and the double meaning of match. And then he uses those sounds all the way through. With a match, I became a man who summoned diesel from the yellow caverns of a 10-gallon jug. And just those sounds just keep all the way down till you get those wonderful Anglo-Saxon line, the slick, hot, straight waiting.
It's quite remarkable. Every part of the poem bears a lot of weight. I like in the middle of it where he's describing this process of using the steam box.
This is what makes the body otherwise.
Otherwise. And you were talking about Anglo-Saxon. It's almost like it means it's wise in an otherly way, or it makes us, you know, in the conventional sense, it makes the body otherwise. It's such a strong point. It bears so much weight in the poem, but it doesn't call too much attention to itself. It calls the right amount of attention to itself. This is what makes the body otherwise, what makes it sing.
To make of the tree a song grown long in a linseed skin, the slick, hot strake waiting to become parcel of the round world again.
Parcel of the round world again. You expect the word part there,
mm-hmm.
but instead he uses parcel. You can just suddenly see that boat floating around the ship. That,
right.
I mean, even the word parcel contains the kind of roundedness that he wants there instead of part, which is
yeah,
hard.
Yeah, that's true. You know, both of these poems, as we're talking about them, strike me as being convincing in the sense that you have the idea that he's composing these poems in his mind while he's working with his hands and his body.
Oftentimes when I'm working, I'm also composing, or, you know, just as interested in the story behind whatever it is I'm doing.
Yeah, it does show you how closely language can be tied to life and how much the way we live has to do with what we write.
Yeah. Know?
Also in the January issue, just to get the year off on the right foot, so to speak, we have a section called Antagonisms. This is not the first time we've had this section in the magazine, but maybe you ought to explain, Don.
How can I explain it?
It was actually my idea, I should
it
say.
Was, that's right.
It was
Chris,
my idea.
Chris should explain.
I have a theory that poets read differently, that they tend to have some major dislikes of poets that everybody else tends to like. And I mean, there are famous examples. There's Eliot on Milton, Ivor Winters on just about anybody. Samuel Johnson didn't like the metaphysicals. There's lots of examples. But if you can draw that out of them and out of the right people, you can get illumination not only on the poet that's being discussed, but also, and probably much more importantly, on the poet who's making the attack.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It shows something about them, right? I mean,
well, it really does. I have a pet theory. It's not true in every case, and I probably shouldn't even mention this, but it strikes me, both with the previous antagonisms in the magazine and some of these, that sometimes when the poets articulate their dislikes, they're actually pointing to a poet whom they resemble in some way.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's very interesting to me. So Michael Robbins sort of knocks Dylan Thomas off his pedestal, and yet there is something in him that reminds me of what you could say about Dylan Thomas and on down the line. I think it's very revealing.
Well, on that note, besides Michael Robbins, we have Angie Malenko calling Elizabeth Bishop, well, she calls it a safer alternative to Ambien. Jason Guriel gets irritated by E. Cummings. We've got Peter Campion, who sort of despairs over the unevenness of D.H. Lawrence's collected poems. Daisy Freed goes after Baudelaire eventually, but she kind of comes around to love him in the end. And then finally, we've got Laura Kosicki running the other direction whenever she reads or hears a poem by this poet.
Suppose we call it Projection A.
Laura Kosicki joins us from Ann Arbor, where she teaches at the University of Michigan. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Let's start at the beginning. Do you remember when you first read Wallace Stevens and what your reaction was?
I'm fairly certain that I was in high school, and it might quite likely have been Disillusionment of 10 o'clock, right? It is 10 o'clock, isn't it? Yes. Not 9 o'clock?
Central time, it might have been 9.
And I perhaps liked it more than some of my fellow students might have who didn't like poetry at all. But yeah, I mean, I remember feeling a little headachy, just maybe a little sick to my stomach, thinking about all that language and knowing that I was supposed to find some sort of key, which my English teacher, I'm sure, had to understanding what the emotional background of it was, since it didn't feel very emotional. It felt more like vocabulary, lots of vocabulary.
Well, you must know many poets and readers. I'm sure tons of people you know adore Stevens, and he's probably come to be the major modernist in the 20th century. So is this something that you've always kept under your hat, or have you always been openly anti-Stevens?
No. When I was asked by you to do the antagonisms, he was the first poet that came to mind. Then, of course, I thought, no, I'd better not do that, because I would just like to say up front that I know that I am no Wallace Stevens myself, that if I were a better person and a better reader and a better poet, I would be able to appreciate Stevens more. And no, I have never articulated to anybody but a few close friends my antagonism for Wallace Stevens. Although I do think that when I taught Poetry 101, I might have let it slip to the students a little bit in looking at some of the poems. For instance, The Emperor of Ice Cream is always anthologized, and students always want to talk about it and how they don't like it, and I'm sure that I probably gave away that I didn't like it very much myself when we discussed it.
Well, being from Tennessee, I always liked that idea that somebody placed a jar in Tennessee. It made it kind of a more magical place than it really seemed to me to be. And then in the essay, you say that the word placed makes him sound so full of himself.
I tossed a jar in Tennessee. I discarded a jar in Tennessee.
So it's not the jar or Tennessee.
I threw a jar out the window of a moving car in Tennessee, but I placed a jar in Tennessee. I just think it's a bad word choice. It does not leave to the imagination how self-important Wallace Stevens might have been.
What is it sort of about his poetry as a whole that you don't like?
What I would like to say, I do say at the end of my antagonisms that I do see that there's poetry there. Perhaps it's a tone thing, like in 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, you know, why not 12, why not 10? Again, like Disillusionment of 10 o'clock, why not 8 o'clock? Things seem pretty arbitrary in his poems, and there are a lot of words, maybe. I mean, this is, you know, is a failing of my education. There are a lot of words in the poems I don't know how to pronounce. I looked them up, but since they aren't words that want, you know, like, what is it, concupiscence, curds? I just don't say that in my ordinary discourse. So I really can never remember how to say it, so it always comes as a surprise to me again when I see it and think, ah, oh, these curds. I think density is what I object to, the language density, the thick woods of all those words. One of the poems of his I like the most, unfortunately, the title for me sums up the feeling that reading most of his poetry gives me, and that is Dry Loaf.
It seems that your opinion coincides more or less with Mrs. Stevens, who apparently found many of her husband's poems a little dandyish for her taste. But we understand that you've gotten into this with your husband.
Yes, he's a Stevens fan.
So what are his feelings on the subject?
He can just he looks at the lines, he can cite them and recite them, and I don't quite understand what he's saying, but he does seem to like it. I mean, that's the thing a lot of times with people who really like Stevens. I don't understand the words that people use to explain the words that Stevens using and why they like them. And plus, I'm really suspicious of it, so I'm not the easiest person to convince about that.
You know, I have to tell you this story, Laura. I was in Cambridge the other night, and I was having dinner with Stephen Burt, and I was telling him about this feature. And first of all, I said that you were in it, and I said, can you guess who she doesn't like? And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, Wallace Stevens.
No.
Have you ever told him?
I don't think so.
I don't know how he knew, but then he asked me, who might I write an antagonism about? Because Stephen Burt said he would write it against Frost.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, you know, there's not a poet alive that I couldn't write an antagonism about.
That you're really going out on a limb there.
Right, yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, Laura.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You can read Laura Kosicki's essay and everything else you heard on this program in the January 2013 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox with help from Posey Gruner.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.